Welcome to Education Perspectives. I am your host, Liza Holland. This is a podcast that explores the role of education in our society from a variety of lenses. Education needs to evolve to meet the needs of today and the future. Solving such huge issues requires understanding. Join me as we begin to explore the many perspectives of education. So we are so pleased to welcome John Nash to the show today. He was born and raised in Silicon Valley and has 30 years of experience in leadership development, strategy design, and social science research. He spent the last 13 years researching how design thinking serves leaders as a lens for change and improvement. John helps education leaders identify opportunities for human-centered innovation to make schools that people want. He's the author of the book, Design Thinking in Education, A Leader's Guide to Collaborating for Improvement, published by the Harvard Education Press. Since 2011, John has been associate professor of the Department of Educational Leadership Studies at the University of Kentucky. He's the founder of UK's Laboratory Design Thinking, affectionately known as the D-Lab. John has held faculty positions at Iowa State University and the University of Texas at El Paso, and was a social research scientist at Stanford University, where he directed interdisciplinary and international teams, research scientists examining the effects of innovative technologies on learning. Welcome, John Nash, to Education Perspectives.
Thank you, Liza. It's great to be here.
Well, it's funny. I should tell listeners, followed you on LinkedIn for quite some time before I realized that you were right here in Lexington.
Just right here. Yeah.
I know, but so much good work and so many and interesting posts. I urge you all to follow him there on LinkedIn. And you have started a brand new podcast as well, correct?
Yes. My colleague, Jason Johnston, who is a director of online learning at the University of Tennessee, Knoxville, and I, we started a podcast called Online Learning in the Second Half of Life, actually, I guess is the, I put my air quotes up there. He and I have been dabbling in online spaces for learning for quite a while. I bet our combined years together is probably approaches maybe 40 years or something, 50 years. And so we're both wondering now, coming out of the pandemic and looking at the turns that P-12 education is taking and higher ed is taking, what can we learn from what we've done so far in trying to teach online? And what can we maybe take forward that's the good parts and leave the bad parts behind?
Absolutely. It is certainly a pivotal time. And I'm so glad to have you talking about it here on Education Perspectives today.
Yeah.
So I normally start out with that big 30,000-foot question. From your perspective, why do we do education at all? Why do we do that in our society?
Those are the kinds of questions that just make me go silent. I want to, because there's like, it's like, I know the answer, but then it's so big there. How can there be an answer? But I was grateful that you had talked a little bit ahead of time and that we would discuss this. And so I've been thinking about it. And I like to think about it in terms of the idea of what is school for? You know, right now, teachers are exhausted, they're unappreciated, but they're very sorely needed. And I think many teachers would also say they're excited. I was looking at an article recently in the New York Times about this question, what is school for? And they talked to students and they talked to teachers and they talked to other pundits. And, you know, there's lots of things that are schools for. It's for economic mobility. It's to take care of people. It's to learn to read. It's to make citizens. But a student that they quoted in this piece, her name is Destiny, and she's 15 years old at Fremont High School in Oakland. She said, school is somewhere where you can build your confidence in life, even if you're not too sure about it. And I thought that was really good.
Brilliant.
But, you know, also my daughter is a public school teacher. And, you know, in spite of everything that she puts up with, district policies, regulations, COVID, family, everything, it's her kids and the excitement that she can generate within them that brings her back every day. And her lens is an English teacher. She's a middle school English teacher. I was actually talking to her about this question this afternoon before we started talking. And I said, hey, what do you think school is for? And she said, wow, I'm not sure, but I'll tell you what I tell my kids. And she's told me this story. She said she once had a very contrarian student who pressed her on what the whole purpose of learning English in seventh grade was for. And she's a good egg because she's well-liked by her students because she kind of tells them like it is. And she says, you know, I said, it's going to be necessary for you to know how to communicate properly, either through words or with numbers or through science or as you engage the earth. Because if you can't, then you're just going to be useless blobs. And to be a meaningful member of society, we have to go through this. And the kid, you know what he said? He said, fair enough. Okay, I'm in.
That's an awesome story. Absolutely. Oh, how fun. I think I'd love to meet your daughter.
Yeah, she's great.
Marvelous. So an education family, tell me a little bit about what drew you into education in the first place.
I took a circuitous route to where I am today, and I came in through education, through special education circles and outside of formal schooling circles, but more around wraparound services and things like that. My first sort of education experience was as a non-certified instructor in Salt Lake City school district in the 80s. And I was in a middle school, junior high severe and multiply handicapped classroom, and fell in love with being around kids in schools and working with learners with special needs. And so that led me to working on a master's degree in special education with a focus on transition from school to work for learners with special needs. So thinking about what folks do after they age out of the system and then get jobs, basically. And so got that master's degree and was also working as a group home parent in a community where we had 6 developmentally disabled adult men living with us, and we were helping them. And so the sort of work was really coming together, both in my sort of home life in the group home and then my master's degree work in this. And then I thought that was going to be it for me. I would get my master's degree and I would work in agencies that would be focused on this sort of thing. And one day during my program, I was in the first day of the second semester of my master's program, and my advisor and I had an assistantship I was working for, this wonderful guy named Walter Skeet Creekmore, Dr. Creekmore. And he said, hey, sit down. I want to talk to you about where you're going to go get your doctorate. And I said, my what? I am? And I credit him to this day as the person who saw in me that I should keep going and go get a doctorate. So I did. I went to the University of Wisconsin-Madison, got a PhD in educational administration, and off I went. And I became a professor at the University of Texas, El Paso. That was my first teaching gig. And so I did that in ed leadership. And so I've been preparing leaders since then.
Very, very nice. And I know that some of the work that you're doing, which we'll get into in a minute, is really revolving around design thinking for leaders. And I'm really excited about that. So given that, tell me, what is it that you love about what you do now?
What I love about what I do now, and truly, Liza, it is almost right now, because there's a lot to reflect on. It's like, well, I love teaching, I love kids, but really, there have been things going on in the past 6 to 12 months that I really, really love doing and talking about. And it's this idea of breaking learners' longstanding habit of what I'll call performance through product. And by valuing teachers as partners and not bosses, and co-designing learning with learners, and teaching teamwork to demonstrate the power of the collective to solve problems that are tough to solve. And along the way, helping learners go through self-growth and grow their curiosity. And I come to all this thinking about this, and why I love this is that we've just closed a semester of a class called Design Thinking in Education that I co-taught in person for the first time in almost a decade with a partner in my teaching crime, Dr. Ryan Hargrove. And we taught design thinking to a set of undergraduates in a very special learning space called the Cornerstone at the University of Kentucky. And it's a space that allows us to have the openness to the public areas of the university and interact with the people that are just passing through the building, as well as teach our content. And we had a partner with the Markey Cancer Center. And all this to say that what we did is, as we went through this idea of teaching this class, Ryan and I met each week for an hour the day after class to reflect on our actions and our thought processes and consider how we could improve the learning experience that we were involved in. And through this process of reflection in action, we've identified specific aspects of our teaching that really excited us. And these things that I just noted above, the thing you said, well, what do you love about what you do? And I wouldn't be able to articulate them the way I did just in such a refined list if he and I had not been in this reflection and action process, thinking about what did we learn this week about our students? What did they complete? What did they do? What do we need to do better? And so it's been a really powerful tool for us in our teaching practice. It allows us to identify areas of excitement and enthusiasm. It lets us continually refine our approach to teaching in real time. And so every time we met, we've redialed in what we were going to do the next time. And it's allowed us to then also code our actions so that we can chronicle them and publish this sort of approach. Because this idea, what we learned by teaching design thinking is that we were already teaching in a transdisciplinary fashion, which has now become a big push here at our university. And so we're able to chronicle ways in which professors and even teachers in P12 can realign their approach to teaching by knowing what to do. I think it's really hard for professors and for teachers to sort of let go of the control of the content and the curriculum and the way the classroom runs. And we found ways to do that so that teachers become partners and facilitators of the learning process and less about didactic, learn this, produce this, push this back. And that's why I call it performance through product. Students come to the University of Kentucky as freshmen after 12 years of being indoctrinated into a very performance model of academics. And so now the push is, how do we get students to think about working collaboratively on teams to tackle problems that are bigger than themselves that no one discipline can ever solve? The big problems that we see in Kentucky, even around health and the opioid crisis and diabetes and heart disease and tobacco addiction, those are all problems that can't be solved by medicine alone. They can't be solved by social science alone. And so we have to rethink the way we teach in our curriculum to be able to bring those disciplines together and let students then learn how to work in a team to solve those problems.
You know, that whole bit there just completely resonates with me, because we had a system and a model that worked for our country for a long time. And it involved that kind of sit and get and regurgitate sort of a model. But it was geared towards kids who were going to be in a factory and needed to sit and perform and that sort of thing. And in this information society that we live in, it's all about that lifelong learning process. And so it's exciting to me to hear about you as a professor using that reflection time to be able to really evaluate what's working, what's not. And I saw the wonderful thing that UK put out, the little short video about your class. And right. It was wonderful to see those students really taking agency and being a part of that solution and sharing their thought process. I was just really impressed.
Thank you. We were excited to teach that in person. That course had been taught online. And so you can imagine all of that craziness that you see in that 6-minute video that we do in person. I've been teaching that class online for almost a decade. In that case, the students are far flung. They don't all sit in Kentucky. They sit all over the country and sometimes in another country. And so I have to run that course as though we are a globally distributed design firm and I'm the managing director and they're the designers who are going out and solving the problem. And that worked pretty well. But then as soon as we begin to teach it in person, all kinds of new dynamics come out, which Ryan and I discovered were really valuable. So we're able to help people think about how they're going to communicate their ideas effectively. And that process of learning how to think like a designer was way more important than if we had a brilliant executed solution for the Markey Cancer Center. That was our win. We wanted them to leave thinking, I know now how to transfer these skills to other parts of my life, other parts of my courses, and I can do things better now because I've learned to think like this.
Exactly. That whole thought process and the design thinking way of going about things, I don't know that many people really know what that is. Can you give us a short primer on it for those of us who have not been involved?
Yeah, sure. So I like to think of design thinking as a solution finding process, not a problem solving process. And so in this case, we try to think about the world as being filled with a bunch of challenges that are usually framed as other people's unmet needs. And the designer in the class, the student who learns to think like a design thinker, is thinking about designing for another. Or as my friend Dan Gilbert and I like to say, we want to make someone's life better. And so to make someone's life better, you have to understand the unmet needs in their life. And so we do that through a first phase of empathy and understanding and need finding. So this phase is where you start to just gather information about other people and what their needs are, usually focused around a challenge that's been brought to us by a partner or something that maybe students have discovered in the world. And then once they've collected this information about the needs of another, they synthesize it in a way that really distills it down to what is the challenge we want to try to solve for this person or these folks, these body of people. And so that launches a brainstorm. So that's step three. So step one was empathy and need finding. Step two was synthesis. Step three is brainstorming. So we brainstorm wildly solutions to the potential problem that we've discovered. And out of that brainstorm, we harvest the 3-4 ideas that we think have some legs, have potential of feasibility, can solve the problem, would be delightful to the users and that are going to take the problem forward. And they prototype. That's the next step. So then they prototype some of these solutions and show them back to the people that they've been working with, say, would this work? So at no point is the designer sort of at the top in this typical leadership pyramid where they say, I know what you need and this is what you're going to get, but rather, hey, we heard this about you. We think that this might work. What do you think of it? And with that feedback loop, we test and we test and iterate till eventually we hand over a solution that could work for the partner and then they can grow it from there.
What has been the reaction to your partners, in this case, Markey Cancer Center?
In the case of the Markey Cancer Center and the focus of the small, the 6-minute film, and maybe we could put a link to it in the show notes.
I will.
They were positive. Our partner was the, in this semester, was the patient advisory group. This is an advisory group to Markey Cancer Center comprised of caregivers, former patients, and other allied service folks who are bearing on the problem of curing cancer. And they help provide input to Markey on their policies and practices. And so we worked with the patient advisory group to think about a critical problem of need inside the center, which was improving the rate at which patients sign up for clinical trials in the cancer center. So part of becoming a highly designated cancer center through the National Cancer Institute, along the lines of the Mayo Clinic and MD Anderson in Texas, these big centers, UK also seeks to have that sort of status. And one of the key metrics in achieving that status is having a good accrual rate, they call it. Accrual, that was my Alexa. Should I say that again? Did she come through? No.
Worked out great. No worries. Okay, great.
One of the important things that university centers will need to do to reach that status is have a high accrual rate, which is fancy talk for being able to sign up a lot of people into clinical trials. And that moment of asking a patient at when they're diagnosed with cancer to also consider being a part of a clinical trial is, as you can imagine, a very touchy situation. And so they came to us with the question, how might we think about improving accrual rates for clinical trials in the face of a recent cancer diagnosis? How do we make the cancer patient experience better such that they would be also inclined to sign up for a clinical trial? And we were able to deliver some solutions to them that they may actually run with. And so we're excited. And what's exciting about it is that the people that came up with these solutions were 9 undergraduate students from 9 different majors at the University of Kentucky, all never before trained in doing any kind of design work, but learned a process to solve a problem that's, what do we call it? It's content agnostic. So design thinking doesn't tend to care what the problem topic is. It just cares that you trust the process and you follow the process. And so in doing that, we were able to deliver a couple of prototypes to the Markey Cancer Center and the patient advisory group that they think will enable them to improve the way in which patients are engaged at the center, and in turn will improve not only accrual rates for clinical trials, but also just the overall good experience.
Boy, that's fantastic. And I love the fact that your students came from so many different disciplines. I mean, you were going to get that brainstorming must have been really neat because you had all kinds of perspectives sitting in the room as to what might be a potential solution. That's wonderful.
Yeah, we did. And we were surprised. That was by pure chance that all 9 students were from a different major each.
I'd like to circle back around to this online learning. Obviously, we had the pandemic, and in one day, teachers were expected to figure out how to be able to teach online, and students were forced to be able to try to do this and whatnot. And so not a really good setup for online learning and the success, but it certainly moved us forward by a huge leap and bound as far as the ability to do teaching and learning and whatnot on an online basis. You were involved in it beforehand. What do you think our kind of lessons moving forward should be? Because I'm a little concerned that some people want to throw the baby out with the bathwater. You know, so tell me a little bit more about online learning and what you see as the future there.
Yes, I was involved with online learning before the pandemic. So in my department at the University of Kentucky, Educational Leadership Studies, we've been teaching our courses fully online for about 8 or 9 years now. So when the pandemic came, it was just another day at the office. And we had to be careful to be empathetic for our colleagues who were just jumping in for the first time. And it was a lot. I think that one thing that I've noticed going forward is that there was almost a myth coming into the pandemic that because we had this ubiquitous presence of computers and internet, many homes were already wired, some of course still not, but that this would sort of take care of itself because computers are smart, right? We have Canvas and we have Zoom and the tools are there. This will just work. And it just missed the mark because it's a myth for a reason, is that you still have to have good content and you still have to have good instructional design and you still have to have all the things in place that you'd expect to see in a face-to-face classroom. And a lot of the studies that have been done about migration to online, even before the pandemic, suggested that it's about 20 to 25% more effort at start for teachers and professors to get their material online. But Liza, the interesting thing is, I'll go back to this topic of instructional design. I think that's what online learning has laid bare, is that the transfer of a face-to-face classroom to an online environment doesn't just go. It really has brought back the importance of good old-fashioned instructional design and why that's important for learners to have good goals, good assessments, structured materials that are presented in a logical fashion. Can't just show up and lecture online like you might expect to do if you were doing a brick and mortar, walk into a classroom and break out my notes. And so I think that's been a challenge. It's been a challenge for a lot of the teaching and learning centers. It's been a challenge for directors of instruction in school districts. And unfortunately, I think, at least in the pandemic, we saw a lot of effort on Zoom that were good classes just started to look like, I mean, just crummy credit recovery experiences. It wasn't the teacher's fault. It wasn't the student's fault. Was it the leader's fault? I think there's contribution to go all around there. We weren't ready. I think we gave the notion to the public that we were ready. I mean, there's a lot of talk about the way we use computers. There have been grants for years from the federal government and state governments and other agencies to infuse computers across our curriculum, but we weren't ready to teach online.
Absolutely. But in the future moving forward, I think that this still has some really incredible potential as far as bringing, you talk about content, and I think that the richness of the content through technology could really be enhanced, you know? I mean, isn't there a neat opportunity for you to, you know, have a visiting professor from MIT come in and talk about his or her particular specialty? I guess, can you tell me a little bit more about what you think the future should be as far as the balance maybe between online learning and in-person learning? And maybe if you have a criteria for choosing which would be better in a certain circumstance?
I don't know if I think that there's one that's better or worse. I like what you said a minute ago. I mean, I think that, and we've had these affordances for a while with Zoom and others to bring in guest lecturers and things like this. I think that educators are also have been lulled falsely into this idea that they have to do everything in order for it to be any good. And we can all start small. So you're right. I mean, maybe it's just brokering a relationship with an expert that you'd like to bring in via video conference to talk to your students about a particular topic. Maybe you've been working on a unit. If it's in a P-12 school, you've got a unit going around a particular science area, and then you can bring in someone from outside. Yeah, MIT, Harvard, you name it, and they can talk to the kids. And so start small. I wouldn't be put in the position of saying whether I would use one over the other, because I think key is back to my other point about just having good instructional design and having it designed well, I think is more important. I've had colleagues approach me in the past when they were in other departments that were thinking about moving their programs or courses online, and they knew that we had been doing it for some time, and they would say to me, yeah, but how do you know that the course is going to be any good once it's online? And I looked them back in the eye and I said, well, how do you know your courses are any good now? And they said, oh yeah, I really don't. And so there's this sort of horse race mentality that we can get trapped into thinking that one is better over the other, but really it's just a matter of being thoughtful about what to deliver. I do think that there are very interesting opportunities arising out of the last 3 or 4 months now that OpenAI and ChatGPT and these other large language models have appeared on the scene. And I think there's a lot of promise. I think there's some, I don't know if I would call it peril, but I think it's we should have perspective on the way in which it gets put in place. But I think that that could be a boon for online learning and in-person learning, because it could allow professors and teachers to be more thoughtful in the way they customize the experience for the learners. I mean, you're no stranger to the idea of personalized learning in the P-12 space and thinking about creating deeper learning opportunities for students so that they can learn to dive critically into areas and topics that they're interested in. I think that AI is going to, in the way we see it now with these large language models, is going to allow teachers and professors to be able to have almost a third hand and be able to develop materials and be thoughtful about learner needs and develop them for them faster than they would otherwise. I think that that's going to be a boon.
I'm really glad that you brought that up, because I think for some people, this whole ChatGPT thing is brand new and they're like, oh my God, how are we going to handle this? And we've certainly got the crowd that are like, oh no, we've got to ban it in school, and oh no, we've got to do this. But I think that that thoughtful use of this new technology is a really, really good thing for teachers, that they could actually use this to save time doing other things. And yet, as you mentioned, be able to personalize almost instantaneously a particular student. I'm really glad you brought it up, because I think it's quite a tool, and it's kind of like when the internet came along, you know, we're going to have to find ways to be able to integrate it into into how we do business, whether that be in school or business itself or wherever.
Yeah. The studies are coming out now. It's still early, and many of the studies are still in draft form as they're getting peer reviewed. Some are in open access, and I'm talking about studies that are being done about the ways in which tools like ChatGPT are a benefit to knowledge workers like teachers and others who can use the tools to expand their knowledge that they already have. And so it can turn them in. So ChatGPT is a very good tool to say, well, it hallucinates and it thinks on its own. It doesn't really, although it can get its facts wrong. So where these tools are most effective is when they're used by someone who already has expertise in the particular area where they want to expand their creativity or their idea base or the things that they'd like to do. So teachers are perfect for this because they know a lot about the content and the topic area that they teach, but they're stuck for time on getting new ideas. Let's say, you know, teachers who have to do all the things that they're required of in their schools that are administrative and otherwise around curriculum and reporting and the meeting for their PLCs and then going to the PD. And so then now you have a tool that I say, I have an idea, but I need a rubric and a lesson plan for it. ChatGPT will write it in about, I don't know, 120 seconds. Something that you would have done over maybe 2 hours. Now you'll iterate on it. I've worked with a person in my class who's a librarian, and she said, it writes the rubric. I said, I would have spent an hour writing this rubric, but now it wrote it in 30 seconds. I'll spend 15 minutes making it perfect, but now I've just saved 45 minutes. And I know from my expertise, this is spot on. I can use this. So I think those are great examples where we're going to see the advantage.
Absolutely. I think that's phenomenal. And I keep looking at that going, all these reports and everything that people are writing that take forever, but mm-hmm. are very specific to answer. I can just see such great opportunities to try to streamline those processes. ChatGPT, write me this report. Oh,
right. Yeah.
Wouldn't that be cool?
That would be cool. And well, it is cool. It will do it. I will say one thing though, I am concerned about, and it has to do with actually an article I read today in the Chronicle of Higher Education, but there's a very popular plagiarism tool that's plugged into LMSs like Canvas and Blackboard. The company is called Turnitin, and Turnitin just announced that they're going to have a module inside their algorithms that will tell teachers and professors whether or not something was generated by ChatGPT or by AI. And this is an obvious knee-jerk reaction to a lot of people you just sort of mentioned. There are folks out there saying, well, there's hand-wringing around plagiarism and cheating, and are they going to do their own work? And we can discuss that. But what I want to point out is that the idea that what we should be doing with AI, oh, and by the way, AI cannot detect AI, apparently. So even OpenAI, the company who invented ChatGPT, has admitted that their own detectors for detecting ChatGPT's output are not very good. So it's only a matter of time before these things are gone out of the way. But look at the effort that Turnitin has put into saying, we're going to catch cheaters. We're going to catch you being bad. When the power of AI is so interesting that we could turn it into a tool for good. I mean, look at the market we have now for catching things. I have a camera on my front door, and it tells me when a package has arrived, and a little box appears on the window as the package falls onto my thing. So we can detect all kinds of things. Why can't AI be used to detect good things in students? Why can't it be used to detect when I should praise a student? Why can't it be used to detect when I should stop my neighbor and say hi to them? There's all kinds of things. Why can't it be used? This is what makes me laugh. Why can't it be used to catch professors writing crappy classes? I mean, why do we have an office of student conduct? Maybe we should have an office professor conduct, because you didn't align your assessments to your learning objectives, and AI can catch all that in a good way, though.
Wow.
And so I think that we haven't thought through how this can be utilized to really support successful course design, successful course experience, looking at learner needs. The Khan Academy is already thinking about ways to put ChatGPT as an intelligent tutor. So as a student struggles with material in there, it can ask probing questions, and the student can answer back and get scaffolding to learn the content that's in front of them.
That's absolutely brilliant. And you know, it comes back around to teaching kids how to think as a very fundamental of what should be happening in school. Because look at this revolution in technology that just happened. We're preparing kids today for jobs that don't even exist yet. Okay. So that whole thought process of, it's not about the content and what you can regurgitate, that's in your pocket. You know, it's Tony Wagner loves to pick up the phone and say, hey, your content is all here. How you interpret that content and what you think about it and how you use it to apply to other situations. There's just we could probably do an entire separate podcast just on that line of thinking alone.
Probably. But your comment reminds me of the reasons why Ryan Hargrove and I teach the design thinking course the way we do, because we want the students to do those things you were just discussing, which is being able to solve through problems, not solve the problem. And so that course is ChatGPT proof. There's nothing to turn in. It's about whether or not you reflected on this thing in front of you, and whether or not you're being able to grow as you think about analogous ways to think about a problem. I mean, you can't turn something in and get it right. In fact, we don't really care so much about what they turn in. We care about how they thought about it when they were working on it. That's the big thing.
Very cool. Yes. And that's so much about why education needs to change. And you guys have been very much on the forefront of that in your leadership studies. Can you talk to me about what you feel the obstacles to moving in all these great directions are in education?
I was having a talk with some colleagues yesterday. There's some very innovative educators in Hawaii. You might know some of them who are affiliated with what schools could be. But these two particular colleagues are at a private academy in Oahu, talking about that sort of thing. Like, what are the obstacles to deeper learning? And we concluded in a very lively conversation that the kinds of change that can happen in spite of what a school district might want to do or what state mandates might want to do around assessment, if the principal is interested in making the change, then that change can happen. But it's also about letting teachers off the hook. Many young teachers, like my daughter, they know kind of teaching and learning experiences kids need to get excited about the content that they're learning and then go forward and learn that. And yet they may feel constrained by curricular constraints or something else. I mean, I know my friend on the call the other day said, you know, she was the director of academics and she said, you in no way are a better teacher to me because you said you made it all the way through the textbook. Let's be clear about that. I mean, it's fine you cover the content, but don't think that that makes me admire you more. I admire you when you're able to make the changes in the way you teach. You can innovate within this box and be able to get the kids excited and do the deeper learning techniques and things like that. So I think the challenges to the question to you posed is, you know, what are the challenges or what are the obstacles to making this happen? I think a lot of it is dispositional. I think it's teaching teachers that it's okay to kind of be a rebel inside this box. You still have to check these boxes, but you can also create the change. And so I think that's part of it. And then also the part of it is that there is some level control. I think principals can still also meet the needs of their supervisors and their masters and their boards above them, but they can still create amazing learning experiences within their school if they decide to. So a lot of it is also just a matter of will. Do you want to do this or not? I think that's part of it also.
Absolutely. Another guest of mine talked about adult problems and how that actually put most of the obstacles mm-hmm. to deeper learning in place.
That's right.
Just because of the love of the status quo, I guess.
Yeah.
But that's kind of actually a good segue into a last question, which is education is kind of siloed. And there's a lot of discussion about education in the popular domain. A lot of that doesn't have anything to do with a lot of the topics that we've been talking about today, with deeper learning and that sort of a thing. Would you like for decision makers about education to know?
I would like decision makers to know that it's okay to be curious. Curiosity is essential when it comes to understanding how you'll move forward through any challenge in schools. P20, you know, writ large. And so I think if leaders would decide it's okay to cultivate a sense of curiosity, then they can better understand the needs of students, of educators that work with them, and they can develop these, you know, more innovative solutions that would truly address bona fide needs. I think a lot of what is happening currently and has for years is that leaders are kicked out of their programs. I shouldn't say kicked out, but they graduate, they emanate from their leadership programs and they're told benevolently by their people, even by me, go lead. And I think that what we'd benefit from is that knowing that leaders, it's okay to be curious and ask those around you what they think. So that's ask questions, seek out new perspectives, engage in real conversations, because you can't know it all and you shouldn't know it all. So we do this in the workshops we do. We have students work shoulder to shoulder with principals and superintendents to create their next policy initiative or their course or their program or whatever, because it's the students, it's the teachers, it's the parents, it's the community members who really know what's going on out there. And if you turn them into your partners through curiosity, I think that you would be much better off. That's what I would like decision makers to know.
What a fantastic answer. And it just applies at every level. I love that. I love that. Well, John, I feel like I could talk to you all day long, but we've kind of come to the end of our time here with Education Perspectives. But I wanted to thank you so very much for being a part here and encourage everyone listened to the new podcast. I'm going to put all of the links and everything in the show notes. And thanks so much for your time.
Thank you. It was a fun time.
Thank you so much for listening to this episode of Education Perspectives. Feel free to share your thoughts on our Facebook page. Let us know which education perspectives you would like to hear or share. Please subscribe and share with your friends.